The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Today was, or this afternoon at least, was one of those times when I tried to think about what I would talk about this evening, but I didn't. My mind didn't have a lot of words, and it was very content. Just to be here in a simple way, and the idea of trying to squeeze words out of my mind to think about a talk that would be about sitting contentedly with what is, just as they are, it just seemed kind of strange, seemed kind of a little bit unusual. Is the sound not so good out there? A little bit louder? So let's see, is that better? Still nothing louder? How's this now? Is that better? I wonder if the knob out there is not so loud. Could you check the knob? Maybe it's been turned off out there. So when my kid was, I don't know how old he was, it feels a little bit loud in here. For me, it's too loud in here. It's kind of echoing. So let's see. Is it working out there? Is it on out there? You don't hear it there? So when my kid was, I don't know how old he was, seven or so, six, his friends would, and him would, they would kind of redo the whole bedroom and spend a long time getting ready for a play, setting up a theater, setting up curtains, setting everything. And once they had everything ready, the play was over. I mean, the game was over. I mean, putting on a play was not, you know, just preparing for it was all the game, not doing it. So preparing for tonight is all about what it's about. And there's something important about that, because if the practice that we're doing is, in a sense, to be with what is in the wisest possible way we can, and life often doesn't go the way we want it to go. And the practice is to know how to be present for that. And so today it's completely different than usual around here. So this becomes the practice of showing up, being present, tracking your mind, seeing your reactions, your responses, seeing where you get stuck, hung up, where you might be judging, where you might be impatient. And trying to be wise about that, and take that as the practice, take that as what we're here to do, is to be present for that. Just like in meditation, you'd be doing that. So, how are we doing out there? Still no hope out there?
That's okay, we're just being present.
Just being present. Okay, so there are chairs in here, so why don't you come inside? I know some of you are really attached to being out there, but I think rather than spending a lot of time getting the play ready. You're happy out there. Good. Well, okay. So now that we have prepared the play and we're all ready to start, what would you like to discuss? Do you have any questions? Anything you want to explore? Anything on your mind today? Yes, and if you could use the mic, please.
I just wanted to thank you for a wonderful presentation by a Dragon Man, a movie that we saw called Departures.
Nice, on Saturday night.
And if there's any way it could be shown again, because I've already been telling people about it and they're really sad they missed it. It was wonderful.
Thank you.
I would love to hear about joy.
Joy? Joy, why?
Why? Oh. I feel it in my heart, that's why.
Tell us about it.
Was it my chance to give a talk today? I'm just saying, okay.
I'm not sure you give a talk, but...
I'm just joking.
It seems a little bit distant for me in the abstract to talk about your joy. What's important about the joy for you?
I think I can give more and be more available for myself as well, so myself and others. I think that lightness that it brings, it does good. It's, more sunshine than darkness for me in some ways.
Nice. So you can be more generous or be more supportive of others and more present for yourself in a nice way.
Yeah.
But what's the trigger for joy? What brings you joy, this kind of joy?
I think being in Sangha, being in this company.
So coming here today was joyful.
Yes.
Oh, nice. I'm delighted. No, I feel joy. Good. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think being able to be joyful, just that ability to have that, like coming up when you, shake a soda bottle and, it rises on top. It's the ability of the heart to have that.
I make a mess sometimes with the soda bottle.
Yeah. You're too joyful in the wrong situation.
Yeah. Now, joy is an important part of practice. Joy and happiness, well-being. It's kind of part of the way station along the way to real freedom. And the idea is that sooner or later, some degree of joy or happiness or well-being, contentment, is a, comes with a practice. And if a person practices for a long time and they have no sense of joy or happiness, delight, well-being from meditation or from their Buddhist practice, that's probably a time to come and talk to a teacher and explore what's going on. And sometimes there's very good reasons not to feel joy. There's all kinds of things goes on in people's lives, and we shouldn't hold up joy or happiness as being the point, or that somehow you're spiritually wrong because you don't have it. But if it doesn't, but if it's completely foreign, or it doesn't seem to never be part of the practice at all, then I think it's maybe a time to explore something, try a different perspective or a different angle, or to kind of study what's going on in the mind, what's going on with you, that never surfaces. But I'm glad it's surfacing for you. Thank you. So right back, you can pass the mic. I saw the hand behind you first, and then maybe.
So, as we go into 2016.
Into what?
As we go into 2016.
You have to hold it closer.
So I guess this will be a little preamble to an actual question.
Okay.
Is, the Atlantic came out with an article, I think today, basically saying that, the world is getting better if you look at the data of the world. Like, we're healthier, we're wealthier, it's one of the most peaceful times in human history. The ratings drive kind of makes the news more negative than the state of the world. So I think it seems like, in general, there's the negative narrative around technology. But I wouldn't be here if it weren't for the surgery that saved my life. My dad wouldn't be there if it weren't for the experimental antibiotic that came out right when he was born. I'm very hopeful in terms of the impact of technology on the world. Relating that to Buddhist practice, I wanted to get your thoughts on the role of technology in improving Buddhist practice. So, for instance, there are now cheap consumer electronics that can measure brain waves. They can tell you moment to moment how calm you are, map it to sounds in your on your iPhone, ocean sounds. And I have a wearable right now that measures my breathing. It tells me how much activity and calm and focus I have during the day.
Has it helped you?
I think it's helped me a lot.
Nice. That's the answer.
Yeah. So but it just seems like meditation is a kind of unique skill in that it's like, imagine you're trying to learn to play basketball well, but no one can see whether the ball goes into the hoop. And until you get really good at it, you don't even really know whether it went in the hoop or not. Is that something that has been used in the community? Is that something where there's like, how much exploration has there been? And is that something that could be used formally as a training tool?
Yeah. Well, I'm not probably the best person to answer your question because, especially about technology and for meditation, mm-hmm. tracking, I just kind of stay the same, but the world changes, and soon enough I become the old school. I suspect that technology is here to stay, and human beings have if the Atlantic Monthly is right, there's a drive to try to make things better or to improve on things, and so the harm that comes from technology will be recognized, and people will try to come up with alternatives and solutions and try to make things better. That which is good and useful for society maybe will just grow and develop, but it's here to stay. I hope that's the direction it goes. Yeah. In terms of meditation, there's a lot of people, especially game companies, who are experimenting or developing software for and websites and technology and brain monitoring equipment in order to try to tap into the modern interest in meditation and mindfulness and to augment it or support it through these technologies. People have been doing that for many years. But it seems like technology keeps getting better and better, ability to measure what's going on in the mind. I saw in the magazine a couple of days ago, a game that had a very soft little, very light foam ball that you could somehow lift up in, I don't know how it floats in the air, but maybe I don't know what it does, but gets it in the floating in the air, and then you move it around into these different challenges in this kind of this little thing in front of you. You get into different hoops and balls and tracks, and you move it all through your thoughts, because there's this brain monitor you wear on your head. And the reviews of it said that most people get a headache after 10 minutes. Maybe after a while you get the hang of it, it's easier. So I think it's remarkable what's going on, and I think that inevitably people will use more and more of that. And at what point in terms of a path of liberation? So a lot of this will help people probably get calm, reduce stress, create a good, a lot of important feedback loops that allows people to improve their health in some degrees and their mental functioning perhaps. It's the way of the future. And how useful it is for the upper reaches of the path of liberation is an interesting question, because some of these things can be a bypass around really coming to terms with the underlying roots of our minds, the underlying motivations that drive us. So, it's possible to get into bliss states a variety of different ways. And there are technologies, before technology, there are practices that you can do that can get you into states of bliss relatively quickly if you do them. And but is it useful to be quickly into states of bliss? Sometimes it is, but sometimes it's it doesn't. It becomes an avoidance of the underlying attachments, the underlying greed and hate. And sometimes all those things are put to sleep, hibernate for a while we're in bliss, but they're ready to pop up. And so people who rely too much on bliss, quick access to bliss, often have to keep going back there, and they live a truncated life. So I think, can you turn the volume down a little bit? It's kind of echoing in my mind a little bit today. Let's see, is that better? People still hear me?
Yes.
Okay. What? Still echo, yeah. It's, it might, It might be that, I don't know, I don't think lower, they can't hear anymore. It's probably... No, it's probably the bass or something. Some adjustment has to be made in this. Well, I have to keep talking. Okay. Any other questions people have, or anybody have? Yes. I think it's better for me if you can hear me. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Next. Oh yes. I'm sorry. I forgot about you.
I'm curious if to hear your thoughts on the tension between, or the dance between, accepting things as they are, not getting pushed around by preferences or judgments of pleasant or unpleasant, on one hand, and on the other hand, striving to improve ourselves or our surroundings to make social change or justice or that sort of thing, and how do we balance those or work with those at the same time?
Good. That's a great question. I don't have a simple answer for you. I don't think I do. You know, or that covers everything you've said. But I think it's very important to have something like meditation, where you sit and learn what it's like to be non-reactive, what it's like to come to zero, where you're not for anything or against anything. You're just fully present for what is. And the reactive mind, the judgmental mind, the planning mind, somehow it isn't triggered. We learn how to be at ease or at peace with what is. And so this is a meditation is a safe place to, in a sense, to accept what is in the moment. Because, you know, if you can feel tremendous anger, and you don't have to act on it, you can accept it, but you don't condone it, you don't engage in it. But you allow it to be there until it dissipates. Or other things. So you learn to do that in meditation. And you get a sense of what it's like to be at that that place of zero, that non-reactive place. And many people don't know that place. But once you know that place well, that gives a person a reference point to be able to watch their minds outside of meditation and have the ability to choose better about when to respond and when not to respond. They don't have to be an automatic pilot anymore, automatic habitual reactions. And so having that ability to come back to zero or to a quiet place, non-reactive place, lets person then reflect more deeply, explore more deeply what else is going on when you have to respond to the circumstances of the world. And one of the things we study is our motivation. So maybe the world needs us, but are we doing it out of greed? Are we doing it out of being egotistical? Are we doing it out of hostility? If we are, then... be really careful, because chances are that it's going to cause more harm in the world than good. And there's a long history of people who think they're doing something really important, but out of their hostility, they set in motion further hostility and comes back and makes it worse and worse. So the ability to have a zero place to observe, then you can look at your motivation. Also, if you have this place of coming, you know, to this non-reactive place, you know how to be there in this place, not for or against. That allows us to study the situation more clearly. And so what is really going on in the world? Are we seeing it clearly without any kind of filters over our eyes? And hopefully we can think more clearly, we can observe more clearly, and then be wiser about when we act and when we don't act. The Buddha's teachings of being fully present in the moment sometimes is understood, unfortunately, by some people, that you're not allowed to do anything else except be radically accept the present moment, just be present. The idea is to work for the welfare of oneself and for others, and have the inner freedom to be able to respond appropriately. Is that how does that sound as an answer? Does that address your concern, or you want to ask more?
Yes, very helpful. Particularly the notion of creating a space to see things more clearly, to see motivations more deeply, to see the patterns that are creating the circumstance that we want to change more clearly, and that then leads us to wiser action or more fruitful action.
Right. And then it's situational about whether you actually do something for the world or it's not the time or the circumstance for it.
Thank you.
So now this gentleman in the back. Soon, I think we have to. I would like to have a woman. There's been a series of men, I think, right? Oh, Mary was first started, but yes.
I'd be interested in anything you have to say about enlightenment. What you think it is? Are you enlightened? Do you know anyone who's enlightened? Are more people becoming enlightened? I'm open to anything you got to say about it.
Well, the concept of enlightenment is often used in Buddhist discussion. I tend not to use it too often, that word. I prefer language like awakening or liberation. And but especially liberation, because enlightenment can be very idealistic and very vague what it is, and often sometimes held up as kind of this big, mysterious, mystical thing that some people have and some people don't have it, and then people compare themselves, and then also there's this idea that kind of a lot of projection of perfectionism, a lot of projection onto practitioners who are supposed to be enlightened, teachers are supposed to be enlightened, and there's kind of an awe, and there's all kinds of things that go on. The idea of liberation is a little bit more appealing to me, that idea, talk it that way, because then you can talk about liberation from what? Freedom from what? And the idea is freedom from suffering, or freedom from the underlying clinging that gives birth to the kind of psychological suffering that Buddhism wants to address. And then and there's a variety of ways in which that our suffering and our clinging abates, lessens. Sometimes it lessens through a slow, gradual process of practice over time, and we move into a freer heart and mind. Sometimes it can happen in dramatic moments, very clear kind of realization experiences, aha experiences, enlightenment experiences. Some people have more of the first, just very gradual, nothing ever dramatic. Some people have very dramatic experiences and it seems like, wow, but it doesn't really affect them. You know, it doesn't really, so what was that? We don't know. Some people have very, very strong experiences that they're never the same again from that. There's so many different ways in which this process of becoming free of suffering operates. And to say it's a singular way, I think, is can be oppressive for people. Can kind of, then people measure themselves and they think it's supposed to be this way, and you know, and they're not doing it. And then some people have the Big Bang thing, and you know, they're held up like, you know, they're somehow mysterious or great. And if you don't have the Big Bang thing, you're not, you know, you're not great. So the idea of freedom from suffering is the goal, and anything else is gravy. How does that sound? Is that's satisfying enough, given your important question?
Do you know people that you believe are enlightened?
Well, since I said I don't like to use that word.
liberated. Liberated. Awake.
I know people who have matured quite a long ways along the path of liberation. Whether they're fully liberated, I don't know anybody who qualifies in what in the Buddhist terms is called full liberation. I know people who say they know people. I've asked some of my monastic friends, like, how many fully liberated people are there in Thailand? Usually they talk about monastics. And to my surprise, they give kind of a range of people, number they think that they're fully enlightened in Thailand. You know, I've met people who are, people in the Buddhist, in our scene, our Buddhist scene, who are supposed to be fully enlightened. And I a little bit know what goes on in the back rooms. And I know they're not. So I have never met anyone that I knew was fully enlightened. But I know people who have, you know, have matured quite impressively along that path.
Thank you.
OK. complicated, but let's see, here's a couple of women. Mm-hmm. And if there's someone of another gender here who'd like to ask a question, please speak up. Yes.
Well, with regard to suffering, I know that you've spoken at times about allowing the heart to break, and that's the best response in some situations.
Well, the heart was made to break.
Yeah, yeah. And so the question that I have is, at the end of that sequence of the heart breaking, it seems like there's a glimmer of joy. And I'm wondering if that's the beginning of equanimity.
Oh. Maybe. It could lead to equanimity.
Yeah.
Many years ago, I was teaching a retreat. And then I got halfway through the retreat, I got a note from one of the retreatants and said something like, "Now I understand when the heart breaks, there's a lot more surface area." For sensitivity, for being present. That was beautiful. So to have a heartbreak and to have a feeling of some kind of joy or some kind of other sensitivity be born out of that. Some people say that when the heart breaks, then that gives a chance for the light to shine through. So there is benefits or value in having the heart break. One of the values that I put most store in is not in the broken heart itself, but rather the freedom or the fluidity that allows our heart to break with ease. Then we don't react to it, we're not afraid of it, we're not upset with it, we don't attack it, we don't feel like something's wrong. We just, you know, it hurts, it aches. And that fluidity, that ease with that, that same ease then allows that to transform into joy or to shift into joy when circumstances change. But if we don't have that ease, then we can get stuck in the broken heart, and then it's hard to open up to the joy when it's time for that. Next.
Thank you.
So, Morgan.
Thanks. Can you speak from the Buddhist perspective about Christmas?
The Buddhist perspective on Christmas. The Buddhist perspective on Christmas. I think that any time that people's goodness has a chance to be expressed, we should all celebrate. So maybe Christmas time is a time some people express their goodness to their family, to the people around them. A lot of goodness gets generosity and goodwill and kind of, you know. So I think that if that's, if, you know, that for that part, Buddhists celebrate and appreciate. But why are you asking the question? What's the concern for you?
Well, I'm not exactly in the story, believing the whole story. So I do like the family gathering and the happiness part. It's the other part that comes with it many times that I feel a little uncomfortable
with.
Yeah,
there's plenty of people who feel uncomfortable. I grew up with Christmas. My family growing up was atheist, but still it was part of the family tradition for generations, right, to celebrate Christmas. And so I grew up with it, and so it was felt very natural to do that when we had kids, to celebrate that too. And my mother would come visit, and my sister. It was like family time, right, for my family. But my wife is Jewish, and it makes her very uncomfortable because she feels a little bit like she's participating in some kind of religious activity which is not hers. And I try to tell her it's not Christian. It's not that, you know, it's just maybe it had their, not for us, you know, it's just a thing we do, is family gathering and exchanging our gifts. But it's hard. What?
Pagan. It's a pagan
Yeah, I've tried to tell that. I've tried to tell her that, but nothing helps.
And then the Catholic Church adopted it.
Yes.
That's all they did.
Originally, it was a pagan. Yep. Anyway, so I know a lot of people feel uncomfortable with it. But I think that, in terms of you asked what's the Buddhist perspective on it, I think is to celebrate what's good, celebrate what's useful, appreciate it. It's an expression of how people live together in life and how they take care of each other and value each other. And I think it should be appreciated. And the part of it which doesn't do that, the part of it maybe excludes people or has an us and a them in a way that's not helpful for society, that should be not supported. And there's no need, from a Buddhist perspective, there's no need to celebrate Christmas.
This is my second time that I come to these meetings. And after my first, the first time that I came, I went around and I was looking at the literature that you have around. And there is a lot of things talking about suffering. And also you say that the heart was made to break. I will say that I think the heart was made to love. And in the process of loving, then the breaking is part of it. But again, that's just the way I think. And I think my mind will accept more the concept of the heart was made to love than that suffering. Because then the suffering is kind of even made myself low on self-esteem or kind of a sad type of thing. But again, it's just a concept. Mm-hmm. I think.
I think it's right. I appreciate what you're saying very much. Just a few things. One is that just as much as the heart was made to break, heart was made to love. And the two are closely connected, as you said. And then, I don't know I don't look at the literature here very often. But it is true that one of the characteristics of some Buddhist scenes like ours is to talk about suffering maybe more than we should. But part of the reason for that is that liberation, freedom from suffering brings joy, brings a happy life. But there's a strong tendency in Buddhism, early in this kind of Buddhism we do, to not hold up some things, an ideal way of being, as the way you're supposed to be. Like you're supposed to be loving, you're supposed to be joyful, you're supposed to be peaceful. Because when people have an ideal they think they're supposed to live up to, some people suffer a lot. Some people struggle a lot, and they measure themselves, and they expect. And then there also, when they do a spiritual practice like Buddhism, then sometimes they're looking to try to make that happen. So the tendency in our form of Buddhism is to try to avoid overemphasizing these good states as ideals, but rather learn how to let go of what blocks the ideal, what gets in the way of the ideal. And then if you can let go of what gets in the way of the ideal, then you're left with what is. And so, for example, if compassion is held up as a big, important ideal, if you don't feel compassionate, then you can look at what blocks my compassion, and maybe it's resentment. And so if you can learn to let go of the resentment, then you're available, your heart's open again, to be able to respond as is appropriate in the situation. It might turn out that compassion isn't the right response. It might be celebration and joy. It might be, right. And so rather than emphasizing too much, a positive state is the point. It's let go of what hinders positive states in general. Is that making sense? But I appreciate what you said, because it is true that sometimes us Buddhists could be a little bit more emphasizing the joy and the love. Yes.
Oh, I'm trying to verbalize.
No, so people hearing sensitive devices can't hear. And maybe this should be the last one because.
So I'll try to verbalize my thoughts as well as I can. But so as a teacher, and when so personally, when I learn something, I really feel that I need to share it with people that I love.
Mm.
And I get in these situations where it becomes one a burden that I feel that I have to share.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's very difficult is sometimes I can't help but have my ego fed because of the attention, because of the gazes that I get. And through that, I feel that I need to take action in a certain way to please people that are listening to me because I try to hold myself to what I say and to my standards. And that has created some suffering for me.
Yes.
In terms of not being able to gauge the situation and react or, again, have my ego in the way of things. Mm-hmm. So how do you deal with that as a teacher?
Well, how do I deal with it?
Or as a person, how would I? Well, you're a teacher. So how does one deal with it?
Well, I appreciate how well you articulated it. You spoke it very well, and it seems like you understand yourself very well to be able to describe it this way. So that I appreciate. So the usual approach here in this kind of practice would be to bring a lot of mindfulness to that, to really, really investigate deeply what is going on, what's driving you, what's pushing you to want to share what you've learned. Some of it is joyful, some of it is want to share something that's valuable and you love, and it's a nice tendency, but there seems to be a compulsion behind it. And what's the nature of that compulsion? And then the second one is, I guess, being concerned about or wanting praise, being concerned how people see you. Those two might be closely connected rather than two different things. And so to spend some quality time looking deeply at yourself, and what is it? What is the compulsion? What is the drive? What's the fear? What's the beliefs that go along with being concerned with how people see you? Is there anxiety underneath it? And try to really sit with that and learn with it and learn how to be free of that anxiety, be free of compulsion. And if you're free of it, then you still might have the urge to want to share what you love, what you discovered, but there's no need to share it. And then you can appreciate the love, and then if it's the right time and place and people are interested in learning, then you might share it. But you don't need to. So a lot of self-investigation. Keep looking. It sounds like you're well along the way. And then if you understand this better, you can become freer and freer. Great. Okay, well, it was nice for me to hear your questions and concerns. I hope it was nice for you to be part of this evening. And this is the last time I think I'll be here for this year. So I want to thank all of you who have come tonight and for those of you who have come over this year. I feel very fortunate to be able to come here and meditate with people and explore the Dharma and share the Dharma. It's kind of a blessing, what this gentleman just said now, to have the ability to share what you love and what you learn with people is a blessing, is a beautiful thing. And I've been able to do this on these Monday nights for a long time, and I appreciate that opportunity and to be with you. And I hope that as of today, right, we're going to move towards the light. Enough of the suffering. The darkness. So as we move the whole new part of the cycle into the longer and longer daytimes, I hope that your heart gets more and more enlightened. Thank you all.